Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. Jim, I suspect your inbox hopefully is not overflowing from our ethnic stereotyping conversation from the end of yesterday, whether from Irishmen or Greeks. Hopefully, most people who listen to this podcast have a healthy sense of humor, as we like to think we do. So, on to the good martini today. And, Jim, obviously, there's a lot of attention for us and for a lot of people who watch the presidential race of the first Republican presidential debate tonight, or debates, I should say, plural. There's an early one and a late one. But the other thing that, without the debates, that would be getting a lot of attention tonight is the last episode of The Daily Show starring Jon Stewart. Usually when these hosts go out, there's a lot of fanfare. We certainly saw that with Letterman earlier this year, and it's happened with other shows as well. And not only is it good that Stewart's being overshadowed, given all he's done over the years, it's just good to see him go, partly because we just don't really care for his brand of politics, but also because he's been quite deceptive and misled a lot of people over the years on a lot of key issues.
I was going to say, what is the number one defense of Planned Parenthood right now, Greg? The videos are edited, right? Now, have The Daily Show ever put up the entirety of their conducted interviews with anyone? No, they have never done that. There are a couple of folks on the right who say, oh, Jon Stewart was never funny. No, I don't think that's quite accurate. Jon Stewart made me laugh a bunch of times. There were two things that were kind of infuriating about Jon Stewart. And he sometimes would acknowledge us. We'd use the term, you know, clown nose on, clown nose off. He kept getting touted as the newsman for a new century. Like, it became kind of this tongue-in-cheek joke during the Bush years from people who really hated President George W. Bush that, well, Jon Stewart's the only real newsman or something like that. And I presume that was sarcasm. I presume that was tongue-in-cheek meant to be that they felt the whole media was being too deferential to Bush. It'll come as an enormous surprise to anybody in the Bush White House that the media was being too deferential to him. But at some point, the idea of Jon Stewart as an actual newsman kind of gained traction. And to me, you have to read the front of the paper in order to understand the editorial cartoon. You have to watch the news in order to understand the Saturday Night Live sketch. And somewhere along the line, maybe the start of the Generation X, it certainly accelerated with millennials. The perception was, no, you didn't need to watch the real news to understand the fake news. And, you know, the fake news, a.k.a. this, you know, the Daily Show and various shows like that, became a substitute for actually watching real news and going on to see what's going on in the world. The second thing which drove me nuts about Jon Stewart was how much he would punch down and send out his correspondents to talk to Idaho pastors who they thought were nuts or Tucson school board members and things like that. And it really, you know, if you really are the single most powerful voice of satire and of parody and of being able to mock the powerful, Jon Stewart and his team sure love to pick on people who weren't particularly powerful. Redskins fans. They used to do ambush interviews and things like that. And it just didn't sit well, I think. And I think it kind of, you know, for folks like us who are not already predisposed to like Jon Stewart, this wild overhyping of effectively a one-sided argument, a one-sided interview. And you know, every single one was like, yo, Jon Stewart demolishes Republicans on this. It just became very insufferable. And so whatever the new guy ends up doing, it will be a different brand of annoyance. than Jon Stewart. And I'm happy to let Jon Stewart go off and ride off into the sunset and never darken our door again.
All right. On to the bad martini. And we thought we had the bad martini on Iran early yesterday when we were talking about the number of Democrats who are slowly announcing their support for the Iran deal. And that still is very bad. But then we got a nice double whammy. First, there was John Kerry saying, we have to pass the Iran deal or else the Iranians are going to feel like they got screwed. Because that's our biggest concern. And then the president gives this speech at American University that goes on for about an hour, and he reiterates his key talking points that this is the best possible deal we could have negotiated, and if you don't like it, obviously you want war. But if that weren't enough, he goes here.
Just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America does not mean that that's what all Iranians believe. In fact, it's those hardliners who are most comfortable with the status quo. It's those hardliners chanting death to America who've been most opposed to the deal. They're making common cause with the Republican caucus.
Jim, we've had a lot of complaints with the president before, but to compare Republicans to Iranian hardliners is about as low as he's ever gone.
It has. And a couple of things jump out about that. One, take that, straw man, because we always believed that all Iranians believe death to America, right? We've always denied the existence of any Iranians who did not hate America. Right. And so, well, Obama showed us. Coupled with the fact that we don't like it because we think it's a bad deal for America. Why do the Iranian mullahs not like it? Because they think it's a bad deal for Iran.
Right.
The idea is that if you come at it with two completely different perspectives, it's as if it's impossible. Our interest is a nuclear-free Iran, right? Iran that is not dangerous to us, a country that does not want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth or do, you know, dangerous things, sponsor NATO. What we want is very different. What they want is very different because they want Israel wiped off the face of the earth. They want us driven from the Middle East. They want us powerless. They want the entire world trembling before their might and spreading the Ayatollah's vision around the world. That's what they want. Why does Obama find it so inconceivable that these two perspectives wouldn't like this deal? Because it doesn't do either one of them. Now, he's got something of a point when he says, okay, the hardliners don't like it because this is seen as a form of cooperation with America. But if you pay attention to what the Ayatollah is saying, he's saying, because we have this deal, it doesn't mean we've changed our opinion on the great Satan whatsoever. And we still hate them. They still chant death to America. I mean, again, why would you think that you could get into a trustworthy a deal with someone who every day, on a regular basis, chants for your death? Why would you trust that person? And Obama never seems to get past it. Oh, we're going to have total verification, except for all the places we're not allowed to inspect. And he never seems to want to address all this stuff. And it's very clear he's chasing the legacy.
Yeah, clearly that's the point here. And it's interesting. Ignore the people who are saying death to America. The leader of the country is saying death to America.
Yes, this is not some fringe. Well, okay, you could say it's a fringe perspective on, the scale of humanity. But in Iran, death to America is a fairly mainstream opinion, or at least it's enforced by the regime.
Yes, the people you're trusting to actually enforce this thing in their own country have this opinion as well. So that ought to be taken into consideration. So, Jim, yesterday the Senate wrapped up its business before the summer recess. When they come back, it's going to be a pretty busy time. There's the Iran deal vote coming up, and then there's also the appropriations process, which the Republicans have promised regular order this year, but Democrats are kind of gumming up the works, throwing up roadblocks to individual appropriations bills. They like the big spending omnibus approach usually. And so as the Senate wrapped up its business heading into the recess, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked about that, saying, what are you going to do when it comes to that deadline at the end of the fiscal year while the Democrats are throwing up roadblocks for these appropriations bills?
Well, let me say it again. No more government shutdowns through negotiation. We have divided government. Different parties control the Congress from control the White House. And at some point, we'll negotiate the way forward.
Jim's kind of a facepalm moment here. We've seen this with John Boehner before. He kind of did that with the fiscal cliff and some other deals. It's obviously understandable that if you're the leader of a congressional body that you want to avoid a shutdown, but why you would foreshadow that tactic with a president like Obama is beyond imagination.
It's been a long, slow erosion of faith in Senate Majority Leader McConnell, and I've been with someone who generally wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, wanted to acknowledge that he did not have an enormous amount of leverage, didn't have an enormous amount of votes to spare in circumstances like this before. Here's ultimately the problem. When we were electing a Republican Senate in 2014, the vision was we're going to pass a lot of legislation that's going to be very popular, very conservative, and we'll force Obama to do one of two things. Either he'll sign the law, the bill into law, or he'll be forced to make an unpopular veto. And other than the Keystone Pipeline, that really hasn't happened very much this cycle. A couple of reasons for this, but a big one is the filibuster is still in place, and there are 54 Republican senators. So unless you can get 6-7, Democrats to sign on, you can't break the filibuster. Now, you may recall last cycle, Democrats eliminated the filibuster for nominations. So people say the nuclear option. We already had a contained nuclear explosion, metaphorically, right? We already have eliminated seen leadership in the Senate eliminate the filibuster for certain circumstances. If it were me, I think we've now reached the point where because Republicans can't get any of their legislation to the president's desk, i.e., you know, not funding Planned Parenthood or things like that. It's time to rip off the Band-Aid. It's time to get that legislation to Obama's desk and make him do those vetoes. Because right now the base is sitting here looking – we elected a Republican Senate and nothing changed. I'm among the mentality that, you know, government shutdown fights rarely, if ever, work out well for Republicans. We don't have the messaging advantage of this. We don't have the bully pulpit of the president. The media is always going to, you know, paint this as crazy Republicans shutting down the government because they're being extreme, yada, yada, yada. So to me, the better solution is get rid of the filibuster and get the stuff on Obama's desk. And at least we can say, look, you know, why are we not, you know, getting this? Because we have a Democratic president. The announcement that we're not going to shut down the government, without the filibuster, what leverage do you have? You really don't have any leverage at this point because you can't get stuff to the president's desk.
Jim, the counter to that is going to be that, hey, that this makes a lot of sense while Obama's president, although it might be hard to sustain the legislation after his veto. The concern, of course, is that if a Democrat wins in 2016 and the Democrats somehow win back the Senate or sometime down the road, maybe not 2016, then they're going to have a much easier time getting stuff through and Republicans won't have the filibuster.
That is true. But remember, Democrats have already eliminated the filibuster last time for the nominations. The next Democratic Senate, which could happen, you know, 2 years from now, could happen 4 years from now, could happen, you know, a decade from now. Hopefully it's far off. But my suspicion is the next time the Democrats control the Senate, the moment they can't get what they want, they'll eliminate the filibuster. And that's what we can come to expect from this. And I think, you know, it was one thing when the filibuster was used extraordinary and you had to do the Jimmy Stewart or Rand Paul or Ted Cruz actual speaking filibuster.
Yes.
We've now entered an era where you need 60 votes and an era where, you know, it's likely that for the next, you know, barring some sort of enormous wave election, one party is going to have, the majority party is going to have somewhere between 50 and 60 votes. And we don't live in an era where you see that many Democrats voting with Republicans and vice versa. So if you want to get anything done, you're going to have to get rid of the filibuster. And for everybody who thinks it's so unthinkable, well, it happened last session. I don't understand why it's so utterly unthinkable now.
Well, tomorrow, obviously, we'll be talking for the most part probably about the two Republican presidential debates. Jim, I'm not aware of any drinking games that have arisen, but with 17 candidates, I encourage folks to pace themselves. It's a long evening, two different debates. Don't play games with too many chugging commands, especially if you're doing it in the first debate as well.
You know, I can't think of anything to do more to damage the Republican base between now and Election Day 2016 than excessive drinking games. Yeah, take it easy out there, folks. We got a long way to go.
Yes, exactly. Plenty more debates to come. Jim, enjoy them both, and we'll talk about them tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.